Tonight's presentation, as you already noticed, is 7 pages of notes. We're going to stick very close to the notes tonight. This time, instead of giving you notes, I largely gave you commentary, so you can go home and read it through and try and figure it out on your own. Tonight could easily become a marathon history lesson. And it's important, and I'm going to try and move through it quickly enough that hopefully we have time to step back from it once we've gone through it. Because it's like perusing the forest, but then you kind of need to step back and get your perspective and take a broader view. Because sometimes we have trouble seeing God's hand in something when we have our face too close to it. And we really do not see God's hand in history, usually in the minute details. We see his hand in history shaping the broad stroke of things. So that's what we'll need to try to keep a balance of those two. Now, as I introduced last time, let me give you kind of the four pieces of the closing section of the book of Daniel. Chapters 10 to 12 are all one piece. They happen at a certain point in time. Let's turn to chapter 10, verse 1 and pick that up. It's our last historical dating point, where it says this happened in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, just a couple of years after the decree went out to restore and build Jerusalem at the end of the 70 years. So it's around 534 probably. Daniel is undoubtedly pushing 90 or plus, and he probably doesn't live much longer than this. The book probably closes here because God was probably done with what he was going to do through Daniel. Chapter 10 through 11, verse 1, which we studied last week, introduces and sets the stage for what follows. We saw that it's a vision of Jesus Christ, Daniel's last and best vision. It ties the end of the book of Daniel to the beginning of the book of Revelation. Daniel's last is John's first. Let's us see the scene behind the scenes. We see that when Daniel started praying, God started doing what? Daniel prayed 3 weeks before God responded, according to Daniel's knowledge, but the minute Daniel started praying, God told him at the end of the 3 weeks, from the day you started praying, I started working. So it tells us that God's working when we can't see him, and we need to trust that he is when we ask, because he is. Again, it tells us that the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood God's angels and powers. God will not overpower the human will, but he will seek to influence. He will seek to even up the score with Satan's influence so that the person can make a real choice. God is in the business of preserving freedom, not getting his way. He'll only get his way within the light of preserving freedom, which is why sin has lasted so long, and there's this whole thing we call the Great Controversy, which, by the way, is going to be the focus of the next segment that will start after spring break in early April. How sin began, why it's been allowed to go on so long, and how it's going to be brought to an end. And look at that old picture. God goes for the long-term solution, not the short-term. And so we see here how God is working, but he's not forcing. He's persuading. The angel says to Daniel, now I've left my reinforcements over there with the prince of Persia. I've come to tell you so you know what we're doing, and now I have to go back and keep on. And when the prince of Persia is done, we got to deal with the prince of Greece, just like we dealt with Darius. God is saying, I always am working on your behalf. And I will continue, Daniel, to work on behalf of your people. Because as long as Satan is around, there will be a threat on God's people. The second part is what we're going to look at tonight. Chapter 11, verse 2 down to verse 39. It traces the history from Daniel's time down to what is called in Scripture the time of the end. We'll sort of nail down what that means, but it's around the time of the close of the medieval papacy's reign, which we saw in chapter 7, went from 538 to 1798, 1260 years, 3.5 times. So we'll trace tonight down to about that point in time. Then next Saturday night, we'll look at chapter 11, verses 40 to 12, verse 3. We're not going to cover a lot of territory, but there's a lot of stuff in those 8 verses or so. It outlines events during the time of the end and the final conflict of this world's powers as they relate to God's faithful people. And then we'll finish up 2 weeks from tonight on chapter 12, verses 4 to 13, sort of an epilogue binding off the entire book. By the way, chapter 11, verses 40 to 12, verse 3 is basically the time frame that Revelation expands on. So you have a little piece here in Daniel that's the microcosm of what Revelation works on. Letter B. Bible study does not concern itself with general secular history. Rather, the history outlined in prophecy always, I believe, deals with those nations, powers, and events which directly affect God's faithful people, highlighting strategic events on earth which relate to the cosmic battle raging between God and Satan, between the forces of good and evil, between God's attempt to enlighten and save, and the devil's desire to deceive and destroy. In other words, I don't believe God gives prophecies to outline history just so that we can kind of be amazed that he knows. You know, in the occult, you have, I believe, satanic powers doing all kinds of things to just kind of dazzle you and keep your attention. God does not do that. When he outlines history, it does show that he knows, but he's always dealing with the issues that relate to his faithful people. He really doesn't outline what happens in China, so to speak, because the scripture focuses around the people of Israel and the outgrowth of the Christian movement. He doesn't even deal with just general secular points of history in the era and area that he's dealing with. He's always dealing with how things are relating to his people, those that are seeking to be faithful to him. For that reason, a lot of times secular history does not hold as a high point what biblical prophecy holds at a high point, because it's looking through a whole different set of glasses. But when we look at secular history, we indeed see that what God predicted happened, and his idea of what was important is quite different than man's idea of what was important. Letter C. Daniel 11 contains no new prophetic vision. There's no vision. Just a prophetic explanation. The angel gives an explanation built on the outline laid down in previous visions, Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. This explanation follows the familiar progression of Medo Persia, Greece, Rome, the little horn, and the kingdom of Christ, or the stone. Additional data comes to light as the prophetic spotlight illuminates certain portions of that historical progression. So let's jump into it in chapter 11, verse 2. And now I tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with a great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has risen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. Three more kings in Persia, and then a fourth that's far richer. Indeed, Cyrus was the king. He was followed. We're down under Roman numeral number 2, letter A, number 1. He was followed by his son Cambyses, then for a short time, a usurper named false Smerdis, and finally Darius the First, or Darius the Great. Then there would be a fourth that would be far richer. That is Xerxes, the Ahasuerus of Esther. And he would stir up all against Greece. And indeed, Greece was invaded by troops gathered by Xerxes from over 40 nations. Though outnumbered, the Greeks defeated the Persians and drove them from Greece forever in 479, and that seems to be the pivotal point when Persia begins to decline. Then it jumps to a mighty king that would arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will, but when he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken. Where does that take you in chapter 8? The goat had a notable horn, which is the premier king, and that horn is what? Broken, and four little horns come up to the four winds. Chapter 8, verse 8. Here, his kingdom shall be broken and scattered, or divided, towards the four winds of heaven. So I believe this is now introducing Alexander. This is letter B. Mighty king, Alexander the Great. His kingdom was broken and divided to the four winds. Alexander died drunk near Babylon in 323 BC after 22 years, and that began a 22-year struggle to hold the kingdom together. So let's look at a map again here for a moment. We looked at this one a couple of nights ago. Indeed, this whole territory of the Middle East here was conquered by Alexander the Great. By the way, why did Alexander the Great attack the Persians? It was a direct revenge against Ahasuerus or Xerxes' invasion 100 years before. But he did so well, he just kept going and conquered everything in sight, all the way over to North India. When he died, this 22-year struggle ensued, and finally, at the close of that 22-year struggle, during which time, number three, two puppet kings ruled for a time at the will of Alexander's generals. There was his weak-minded half-brother Philip, and then there was his posthumous son Alexander. But finally, in 301 BC, at the Battle of Ipsus, the kingdom was divided between the four generals. Cassander took Macedonia, which is off the map up there to the left. Lysimachus took Asia Minor, which would be western Turkey. Seleucus took Syria-Babylon, which was eastern Turkey, all the way over to India. Seleucus took the lion's share, take from about the end, from where it says Euphrates River, and go clear to the east, as far again as the map is wide, and you've got the area that Seleucus took. What would be called Mesopotamia or Babylon or Syria, all kinds of different names given to that era over time. And then Ptolemy took over Egypt down in the south. Now it says that his kingdom would be broken up and divided to the four winds, but not among his posterity. Notice his son was not able to hold it together. Not according to the dominion with which he ruled. Unity was never regained, so the greatness of the kingdom was always divided from then on. For the kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. What ensues now is a very tumultuous period of history. The four generals were allies in 301 at the Battle of Ipsus, but 20 years later they began the war amongst themselves. The territories traded hands, kingdoms were reshaped again and again, rulers rose and fell, and the next two centuries are very complex and very unstable, as we'll see as we move on to verse 5. Now, verses 5 to 15 pick up the rivalry between two divisions of Alexander's empire, what's called the King of the North and the King of the South. North, I believe we'll see clearly, simply refers to the Seleucid kingdom, or Syria, up to the north of Palestine. And the King of the South is very clearly pointed out, as we'll see, to be Egypt. Now here's an interesting thing to look at. And by the way, we'll be looking at the north and south again next week when we look at the time of the end, because these play in to the understanding. If you go from Jerusalem over to Babylon, is it north or east? It's almost due east. The kingdom over here of Seleucus is really east of Jerusalem. But how do you get there? There's only one way. You can't cross this desert. It's virtually impassable, especially with animals as your means of travel. The only way to survive is you go north up to the river and then you head down the river. So even though all of this area up here might be west, might be east, or might be north, all of this is always considered by the Jews as the land to the north, because you had to go north to get there. And though Egypt is really more south, more west and somewhat south, but more west, you have to leave Jerusalem heading south, then go towards the west, and then on down into Egypt. So Egypt was considered south. Now it's all kind of skewed, but when you left Jerusalem, you had to go north or south to get to these kingdoms. So the king of the north is always the area of Babylon. The king of the south is always the area of Egypt. And we will discover that it does not necessarily define who's there. It's that direction, or it's whoever is ruling that area is the king of the north. And whoever's ruling the area of Egypt is the king of the south. Now, the time we're looking at is the time of the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic kingdoms. Verse 5. Oh, one other point I want to make before we move on to verse 5. Between the north and the south, number 3, Judea is caught in the middle. So Jerusalem here and Judea is caught between these two kingdoms. Now, what happens when the kingdom of the north wants to attack the kingdom of the south? There's only one way. He has to march right down through Judea and Jerusalem in order to get over here. And there's a phrase that comes up in verse 9 that says he will overwhelm and pass through. And what you see in the picture of verses 5 to 15 is almost the concept of like rising floodwaters. When the king of the north wants to get at the king of the south, his soldiers, tens of thousands of soldiers, come through Judea, living off the land, pillaging, raping, and murdering as they go, to get at the south. And when they go home, it's like receding floodwaters going back the other way. And the next thing you know, the flood comes up from the other side as the south is trying to get even, and they come pouring through Judea up to the north again. So poor Judea gets caught in the middle of two warring powers. Now that's going to be important when we look at the north and the south in the time of the end in which we live, when we look at next week at Daniel 11, 40 to 45. God's people caught between two evil forces that not only hate each other, but hate God's people. And the floodwaters, if you're not getting it from one side, you're getting it from the other. And indeed, in this world, God's people are kind of caught in the middle, aren't we? Satan doesn't like us, the world doesn't like us. Our only safety is trusting in the Lord. So this overwhelming and passing through seems to be the concept of God's people caught in the middle between these warring forces. Okay, verse 5. Then the king of the south will become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Okay, now we're doing commentary on your page with left and right columns. So we'll just work back and forth. Follow along. Then the king of the south shall become strong. That appears to have been Ptolemy I, who established the kingdom in Egypt. As well as one of his princes. That appears to be Seleucus I, who joined in league with Ptolemy and was helped in the establishment of the Seleucid dynasty by the Egyptian king. And he shall gain power over him and have dominion. Seleucus established his kingdom up to the north, became stronger than Ptolemy, and thereafter is referred to the king of the north. And his dominion shall be a great dominion. Indeed, Seleucus I, even though he was helped to get into power by Ptolemy from the south, ended up with the greatest lion's share of the kingdom. He was the greatest of all the rulers after Alexander. Verse 6, a fascinating little story. At the end of some years, happened to be about 35 years after Seleucus the First died, they shall join forces, that is, the north and the south, would try to make a political pact by which they would have peace between themselves, because they were beginning to quarrel. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. They are going to solidify peace by marrying each other's kids. You know, that's been happening ever since then down to the present. It never has worked. But they're trying it. Now, it so happens that this daughter was named Bernice, or Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, Ptolemy Philadelphus, and she was sent up to the north to Antiochus II, Antiochus Thales, who was the grandson of Seleucus I, to make an agreement. In order to make this agreement between the families, Antiochus up north had to depose and divorce his wife Laodice and marry Bernice. So Antiochus dumps his wife Laodice and marries Bernice. Bernice promptly gets pregnant and has a son. Now, continuing to read on in verse 5. She comes up there to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up, and those who brought her, with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. In other words, the whole thing goes down in flames. Well, here's how it went down. About the time that Antiochus II deposed his wife Laodice and married Bernice, she had a son shortly thereafter. And then, after the son was born, Laodice wooed her husband back. So the old wife came back into the picture, got the husband's affections back, but then all of a sudden he died. Probably she poisoned him. Then it says she would be given up. Bernice was killed by Laodice, and the entire entourage was massacred by Laodice. And shortly after that, Bernice's father died. And of course, Antiochus was already dead. Now, there's some strange wording in there that could refer either to the king being killed or the son being killed. But the whole point is the whole thing comes crashing down. Laodice 1, Antiochus 0. That seems to be the way it came down. So Bernice goes north. It says in verse 5, she shall not retain the power of her authority. Bernice is put away by Laodice, who gets reconciled. And neither he nor his authority shall stand. Antiochus is killed by probably Laodice. But she shall be given up. Bernice is killed. And those who brought her, her entourage, was massacred. And with him who begot her, her father died about that time. And with him who strengthened her in those times, Antiochus went down. The whole thing goes down. And that's usually what happens in politics. Verse 7. But from a branch of her roots. Oh, by the way, verse 6 tells us why verses 7 to 15 happen. For the next 200 years, they tried to get even over this event. You see? The next thing is the brother of Bernice, who's the new king down south, has to get even with what happened up north, right? Has to avenge his sister's death. Well, of course, if he's successful, then the north has to avenge their honor against the south. Well, that means, and it's back and forth for 200 years with the Jews caught in the middle. Verse 6. A branch from her roots, that is Bernice's brother, shall arise in his place. He takes the place of his father who died. And his name, by the way, was, I'm looking at the wrong spot here, Ptolemy III, Bernice's brother, came to the throne, who shall come with an army and enter the fortress of the king of the north and deal with him and prevail. It so happens that Ptolemy III gathered a huge army, invaded Syria, and successfully attacked and overcame the kings up there and went home with great spoil. Verse 8, he shall also carry their goods captive to Egypt and their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So indeed Ptolemy III went up and was very victorious, took much gold and silver and booty, and outlived the king that he overthrew. I put a little note there in verse 8. Verse 8 clearly identifies the king of the south as Egypt, because he goes to the north and attacks, and he returns to where? Egypt. Okay. Verse 9. Then the king of the north, see, king of the south got even, now the king of the north has to get even, shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. About that time, Seleucus II marched against Egypt to retain his lost honor, but he was defeated and forced to return home empty-handed. Page 3. However, verse 10, his sons will stir up strife and assemble a great multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through, and then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. Seleucus III, who succeeded Seleucus II, and then followed by his brother Antiochus III, continued the feud. They assembled a huge army and invaded south towards the area controlled by Egypt. They will assemble a great multitude. They planned a great army. One shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Ptolemy IV controlled Palestine. So Antiochus III first marched against Ptolemy by invading and conquering Palestine. Then he shall return home. He realized he couldn't proceed, so he went home to gather more force. Now he had a jumping off place because now he was in control of Palestine. Verse 11. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out to fight with him, that is with the king of the north. He shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. Well, now we see the tide turns finally. The king of the south, Ptolemy IV, goes out and meets Antiochus III at Raphia near the Palestinian border of Egypt in 217 BC. Antiochus III had mustered a huge army of 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, 102 elephants. And yet, Antiochus III was defeated by the king of the south, lost 10,000 infantry, 300 cavalry, and 4,000 prisoners. So the king of the north hasn't had too much success so far. The king of the south sent his sister up there. She got massacred. The king of the south went up to take revenge, and the king of the north has not been able to overwhelm, and we've gone through 40 or 50 years. But who's caught in the middle? God's people, the Jews, who are living during this time, can see it all happening, back and forth. Here we go again. And they're caught in the middle. God's people caught in the middle between these warring factions. Verse 12. And when he has taken away the multitude, that is when the king of the south, Ptolemy IV, had destroyed Antiochus III, he did not make the best use of his victory. There is a typographical error there. I say in the notes under verse 12 in the right-hand column, Ptolemy IV did not failed. strike out whatever words you want to. He failed to make the best of his victory. His heart was lifted up, and he cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. Indeed, Ptolemy IV was a vile and indolent man. He was moved against the Jews, destroyed 40,000 of them in some action at this time, but did not prevail. Both he and his queen suddenly died mysteriously in 203, and his son, only 4 or 5 years old, Ptolemy V, took his place. Now, this is the king of the north's opportunity. He doesn't have a strong king in the south anymore. He's got a child king. It's time to get revenge. Verse 13, for the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. And indeed we find that after the defeat at Raphia, Antiochus III regrouped his forces, formed alliances, awaiting his opportunity for revenge. The accession of the boy king gave him the opportunity, and in 201 BC he heads south to invade Egypt. Verse 14, in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south, also certain violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. Verse 14 has much disagreement among the interpreters. Is it talking about further battles between the north and the south in which the Jews get involved? Or is it talking about the entrance of the power of Rome? The phrase, certain violent men of your people, is what the New King James says. Other versions say it differently. Literally, it says, the sons of the breakers of your people, the sons of the robbers or destroyers of your people. Now, number two there under the under letter C, this can be interpreted subjectively or objectively. If it's subjectively, it would be the destroyers or breakers among your people, which could refer to some Jews at this time who took advantage of the situation to advance their own national interests. If it's interpreted objectively, it would be the breakers of your people, and I believe then it would introduce the power of Rome, which would ultimately be the destroyer or the breaker of God's people, the Jews, as well as the rest of the world, as clearly pointed out in the prophecies of the previous chapter. Do you recall that the iron legs of Rome were the ones that broke and crushed? The fourth beast of Daniel 7 was the one that broke and crushed. The breaking power, the crushing power is Rome. And this is exactly the period in history when Rome, there off in the west, begins to exert its influence, and within 50 years has taken control of the scene. I believe verse 14 actually introduces this breakers of your people, the coming of the power of Rome, the crushing, breaking power of the previous prophecies. Number three. Though verse 15 continues the conflict between north and south, it's just another verse or two, prophecy and history concur that this is the time when Rome makes its appearance on the world scene and begins to make its presence felt, rising to dominate over the north, the south, and Palestine. So literally, I believe verse 14 at the bottom of the page says, and the sons of the breakers of your people, or the rising power of Rome, shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision. The rise of the crushing power of Rome fulfills the visions of Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, the iron and the beast power, which would crush, break, devour, and trample. So just as that power was said to arise, now according to the vision, it is arising. But they shall fall. Here we have a hopeful look ahead, which God often does, and says, look, it's going to be pretty bad, but don't worry, in time the breaker will be broken. Even this awesome power will be brought to an end, and God's people will be delivered and vindicated. This is a reminder to keep our eyes on the bigger picture, keep our eyes on the prize, and not just on the immediate trouble. So here come the breakers, but don't worry, they won't last forever. Remember, that power will be broken without human hand in the judgment of God. Amen? page 4. Am I going slow enough for you? Verse 15 is the last of the feud between the north and south, because by the end of verse 15, the time has come when Rome is truly coming into control. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city. Verse 15. And the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops will have no strength to resist. The king of the north, Antiochus III, came and took Gaza in 201 BC. That's when he was attacking the baby king down south after a considerable siege. And he also attacked Jerusalem. So he puts up a siege mount and takes a fortified city. And the forces of the south shall not withstand him. The boy king lost control of Palestine, never to regain it again. And even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Indeed, a large Egyptian army was cornered at Sidon and forced to surrender. And this seems to be the end of this struggle. Not because they quit hating each other, but because Rome now becomes an integral part of what's going on. Verse 16. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. Rome, the ultimate power, now steps into the scene and begins to execute its invincible will against the Middle Eastern world, ending the focus on Antiochus versus Ptolemy. No one shall stand against him. Rome rose to be dominant over both territories. And he shall stand in a glorious land with destruction in his power. Rome is that destructive, desolating power that ends up taking over the glorious land, or Palestine. Indeed, the Jews entered into an alliance with Rome in 161 BC, enjoyed nearly a century of relative peace under Roman protection. Then in 63 BC, Pompey intervened in an internal power struggle in Jerusalem and Judea, was forced to give up its independence and became a Roman province. Rome has now risen to dominate the former Seleucid kingdom, or the king of the north, and therefore now assumes the position of king of the north as the dominating power over God's people in Palestine, and continues to move south into Egypt. Verse 17. Now we come to the section where I call it the section of the three Caesars. You see, you might be strolling along through this prophecy or through this explanation, and you might say, now, wait a minute, how do we know that's when Rome steps in, and how do we know all this? Well, all of a sudden, it's like you hit verses 16 and on, and you get to some familiar stuff. And we know we're in the time of Rome. So if you backwards then and back up, you know that these other verses would be getting to the rising of that power. Verse 16. Verse 17. He shall also set his face. Now, I'm suggesting this is the destructive power of Rome, as introduced in 14 and showing up in 16. He shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. The Jews went into alliance with Rome as their protector, and they all headed south to try and deal with the king of the south. Thus he shall do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she will not stand with him or before him. Okay, I believe we're at the time of Ptolemy the 11th, or Ptolemy the Golden, who had died in 51 BC, leaving the kingdom to his two children, Ptolemy, his son, and Cleopatra, his daughter. So he shall also set his face to enter the strength of the whole kingdom. Julius Caesar now arises to power, and moving down through Palestine, with full force, seeks to subdue Egypt and make it a Roman province, thus ending the Ptolemaic dynasty. Upright ones with him, 3,000 Jews joined in this process. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it. Julius exiled Ptolemy. We are told that Julius said to young Ptolemy, the brother of Cleopatra, I hear that the fishing is good in the Caspian Sea, which basically means go fishing or die. And Ptolemy went fishing. He left town because he knew that was his only way. He went up there and lived well for a while. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it. Julius forcibly married Cleopatra, thus making him the legitimate heir to the throne of Egypt. But she will not stand with him nor before him. We all know the story, whether it's through the movies or history, of Cleopatra and how she could not be trusted, and how she used her feminine wiles to maintain her own power, not the power of Julius. And of course, after Julius was gone, she turned her affections to Mark Antony, the rival of his heir Octavian. And we know that story from history much better than a lot of the other stuff we've been talking about. Verse 18. And after this he shall turn his face to the coastlands. So after Julius succeeded in taking over Egypt, he turned his face to the coastlines and shall take many. Indeed, he subjugated Sicily and the Greek Isles and sent word back to Rome, I came, I saw, I conquered. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. A tough couple of phrases there, but it appears to have the concept that somebody felt Julius was getting too much power and it was a reproach to them, and things begin to a backlash. Verse 19. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Julius returned to Rome victorious, was proclaimed dictator for life, which indeed he was, but his life wasn't long. The word denotes a sudden fall, and indeed he was assassinated on the Roman Senate floor in 44 BC. Verse 20, there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. Who was that? Augustus rose as the successor of Julius, and it was indeed under the decree of Augustus Caesar, Caesar Augustus, that there was a decree that all the world should be taxed, including Judea, and that's what had Mary and Joseph traveling from Nazareth to Bethlehem, which fulfilled prophecy because Jesus was born there. So there will arise one who imposes taxes, but in a few days he will be destroyed, not in anger or in battle. Now, a few days in Bible prophecy can be a few years, and indeed, Augustus reigned for 40 years, and then he was destroyed. He died, but not in anger or in battle, a rare thing for a Roman politician. He died in bed of old age after 40-year reign. Page 5. So notice, we have two Caesars. The one that suddenly falls, the one that imposes taxes, Julius Augustus. Verse 21. And in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he will come in peaceably and seize the kingdom with intrigue. Tiberius follows Augustus. He was a stepson. He was a paranoid drunk. He was eccentric, misunderstood, and unloved. It said they wouldn't give him the honor of royalty, and indeed Augustus really didn't want him to succeed him. But by political maneuvering, especially that of his mother Livia, the aged Augustus was compelled to adopt Tiberius and appoint him to the throne, which he ascended without violence. He was hated by both the Senate and the army, and he died in seclusion under highly suspicious circumstances. So it says they wouldn't give him the kingdom, but he, by intrigue, would seize it. And indeed, that's how Tiberius came into rule. Verse 22, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. The force of arms, Tiberius' army, was successful in expanding the empire to the north and the east. He was also very cruel to the Jews, and he also went against the prince of the covenant. Indeed, Jesus Christ was crucified under his rule by the order of Pontius Pilate, the Roman procurator of Judea. So please notice, we have three successive rulers. One has the sudden fall and gets involved with the woman in the south, Julius. The next one is the raiser of taxes, Augustus. The next one goes against the prince of the covenant, Tiberius. I think that's a real good anchor point. You know, verses 14 to 17 could be a little iffy what's going on, 14 to 16. We've got good data all the way down through 15. We know exactly where we are in 17 through 22 with the three Caesars. And so we can kind of move back in some of that difficult language. We can work with it. We know it's the transition. Do you follow that? That's how I deal with it. Now, verses 23 and 24 seem to give kind of a broad view of what's going on. Speaking of Rome now, he shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. Oh, I forgot verse 23. I started in 24. Let me back up and read 23. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong by a small number of people, and he will enter peaceably and disperse the plunder, etc. Now, I believe the best I can do with these verses is that this may be talking about specific events that happened in the power of Rome. But at least it outlines beautifully the kind of a power Rome was. Reading the right-hand column. Rome developed a strategy or a policy of arranging what would today be called mutual assistance pacts, or treaties presumably intended to protect and promote mutual interest between allies. The implied threat of total destruction was used to manipulate nations to accept Rome's offer of protection. Then, from within this disguised role of friend and protector, Rome would work deceitfully by turning these agreements to her own advantage, eventually absorbing these allies into the empire and gaining absolute dominance. The Roman emperors, who ruled at the will of the populace, developed the practice of buying the votes by distributing gifts, distributing the plunder. They plundered other nations and any of their own people who fell out of favor, distributing the spoil to the populace to support the ever-increasing demands of the people and thus stay in office. Any hint of disloyalty by a wealthy person was enough to have him banished and his wealth go partly to the informant and the rest to the emperor. This is why when the Jews said to Pilate, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend," they were immediately effective in persuading him to condemn Jesus to death. There's a period of time here, if you read, I've got one book at home, it's about two pages on each of the Caesars. You know, it just goes through them, or three or four pages. It's a rapid history. And when I read that through, it was like so much made sense. Because they all use this policy of claiming, of threatening. It's kind of like the cop who goes by and says, "You need to pay me $10 a week so you won't be broken into," you know, to the shop owner. So there's the implied threat and there's the implied protection. And Rome would do that. Their destructive power was so complete that other countries that they were going to attack would sue for peace. They'd appear to have a cooperative arrangement, which Rome would then turn to its own good. The other point at the next verse, 24, is that the Caesars would take the plunder home and the head of the army would take the plunder home and distribute it so that he would be put in as the next Caesar. And it became a welfare state where the populace lived off the government, who had to find more and more resources in order to keep all the populace happy by paying them off. And the guy who could come up with the biggest payoff was made the next Caesar. You also find that they had this practice that if someone of repute could even insinuate that someone else of great wealth was a traitor, the Caesars, who wanted an excuse to plunder their property and get the money, would banish the person, take over the estate, and give a small portion to the accuser. And so you have a lot of rich people preying on each other at this time, which helped me understand immediately why when the Jews said to rich, power-hungry Pilate, "If you let this guy go, you're not Caesar's friend." That was an absolute direct threat, which Pilate knew would cost him everything if he didn't give in. And I came to understand that phrase when studying this context. Now, verse 25 is the "I don't know" section. I'm sorry about that, but I really don't. Verses 25 to 30, I figured if you don't know what's going on, you just as well admit it. It appears in verses 25 to 30. Well, let's read them. "He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up with a battle with a great, very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, and they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat the portion of his delicacy shall destroy him, and his army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it will not prosper, for the end is still at the appointed time. While returning to his own land with great riches, his heart will be moved against the Holy Covenant, and he will do damage and return to his own land." There seems to be some history there, which seems to me it ought to be easy to find, because there's some specific stuff and we know the approximate era, but I haven't found it. So I don't know what it's talking about. The time frame at the bottom of page 5, letter D, seems to fall between the reign of Tiberius, which is verse 22, and the rise of the medieval little horn, which is up in verse 31, or around 538. So there's a 400 years that could elapse in here. Some great struggle with the South seems to be the focus. I don't know what it is. Rome's internal struggle of intrigue and assassination among the emperors could be intended, speaking lies at the same table and killing each other. Rome's attack against the Holy Covenant, mentioned in verses 28 and 30, could refer to attacks on the Jews or persecutions of the church. Rome certainly participated in both. But the exact historical fulfillment has not come clear to my satisfaction as yet. So, we'll move on. Verse 31, letter A. This section clearly refers to the physical and spiritual desolation of the little horn of Daniel 7 and 8, fitting the time frame revealed in Daniel 9. Pagan Rome destroyed the temple in AD 70. The papacy worked spiritual desolation during the Middle Ages, 538 to 1798, the three and a half times of chapter 7. Now, what I've given you on the rest of page 6 is simply phrases from Daniel 11, verses 31 to 37, and parallel phrases from Daniel 7, 8, and 9, simply to show you why I believe, once we hit verse 31 down to 39, we're dealing with the medieval era of the Little Horn Power, as pointed out in Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. Verse 31, "And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily." That should be familiar, shouldn't it? Chapter 8. "And place there the abomination of desolation." Now, looking at the notes, verse 31, "Forces mustered by him, an army was given over to the host," or the horn. I mean, a host was given over to the horn in chapter 8. "They shall defile the sanctuary fortress." Chapter 8 says, "Place of the sanctuary was cast down and trampled underfoot." Chapter 9 says he would destroy the city and the sanctuary. "They shall take away the daily." That's chapter 8, verses 11 and 12. Taking away and opposing the daily. "And place there the abomination of desolation." Chapter 8 talks about the transgression of desolation, and chapter 9 talks about the on the wings of abomination comes the one that makes desolate. And we noted in that prophecy that it's very clear that that's after the time of Christ. It's talking about the desolations on into the medieval era. Verse 32. "Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits." The phrase, "those who do wickedly," chapter 8 talks about they do it because of transgression. "He shall corrupt with flattery," chapter 8 talks about causing deceit to prosper. Verse 33. Now, I'm going to come back and deal with the phrases that aren't paralleled, okay? Just hang in, we're going to look at the parallels first. Verse 33, "And those people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering." Parallel phrases, "for many days," Daniel 7 says, "for a time, times, and half a time." "They shall fall by the sword and the flame and the captivity and the plundering." Indeed, Daniel 7 said the little horn would make war against the saints and prevail, cast down the host and trample on them. The host would be given to be trampled underfoot, and he would destroy fearfully. Verse 34. "Now when they shall fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them by intrigue." Many shall join them by intrigue. Chapter 8, verse 25, he would cause deceit to prosper, cast truth to the ground, and understand sinister schemes. Intrigue, deceit. Verse 35, those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Some with understanding shall fall. The saints will be given into his hand. Chapter 7, chapter 8, he'd cast down the host and the stars, destroy many in their prosperity, destroy the holy people. Until when? Until the time of the end. Chapter 8, verse 17 says it goes till the time of the end, for it is still for the appointed time. Or chapter 8, verse 19, at the appointed time, the end. Verse 36, "Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done." King will do according to his will. The little horn had an appearance greater than his fellows. and a king arose with fierce features, dominance. He will exalt himself above every god. We saw in chapter 8, he exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. He magnified himself in his heart. He rose against the prince of peace, princes. Verse 36 said he would speak blasphemies against the God of gods. Indeed, chapter 7 said he would speak pompous words against the Most High. And then it says he would prosper or prevail against them, chapter 7. He did this and prospered, chapter 8. He would prosper and thrive, chapter 8, verse 24. How long? Until the wrath has been accomplished, or until, verse chapter 9, the end of the war, the desolations are determined. For what has been determined shall be done, even the consummation of what is determined. Verse 37, he shall regard neither the gods of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above them all. Notice in verse 37, he shall magnify himself above them all. He grew up to the host of heaven. He magnified himself in his heart. Chapter 8, page 7. Those are the parallels. I did that simply to show you that I believe verses 31 to 39 parallel the medieval little horn of chapter 7 and 8. What else do we have in this passage then that talks to us? In verse 32 you have the phrase, but the people who know their God will be strong and carry out great exploits. Indeed, during the medieval era, God always had faithful people who could not be stopped from proclaiming the truth regardless of threat, imprisonment, torture, and death. And no matter how hard the little horn and Satan tried to prevent the gospel from going out and keep truth under wraps, they just couldn't do it. God's people continued to carry out great exploits. You can read the history of the various reformers and the Waldenses and the Huguenots and others. Verse 33 uses the phrase, those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Indeed, the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the gospel. The death of the faithful brought more into the faith. There were always faithful instructors, no matter what the little horn tried to do to stop them. Verse 34, now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help. At times, God miraculously rescued his people, but at other times, he allowed them to suffer. When you read the history of the Waldenses, it's interesting. There was times that strange circumstances happened that caused entire armies that came up to try and destroy those little towns up in the mountains of the Alps in northern Italy, where these people who didn't agree with the papal power were living peaceful lives in the valleys. The Pope would promise plenary indulgence. If you died in battle, you'd go straight to heaven, no purgatory, no hell. If people would go and help destroy these evil nonconformists, the Waldenses, and there would be just masses of rabble that would be led up into the mountains like ants to destroy the Waldenses. And at times when you read the history, God, or, you know, I think it was God, natural circumstances under the power of God, there'd be snowstorms, there'd be floods, there'd be fog that was so thick that the entire army would march over a cliff, you know, because they couldn't see where they were going. And yet, every once in a while, they'd get through, a village would be plundered, people would be killed. God helps a little, he lets natural things take their course a little. I don't understand why he chooses when he does, but that seems to be the picture of this verse. They'd be helped with a little help now and then. Verse 37, he shall regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. Church tradition and papal edict had greater authority than the ancient faith based on the word of the Bible, so he did not regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women. It's the desire of every Jewish woman to be the mother of the Messiah. Even the truth about Jesus was not spared the desecration of pagan corruption, nor regard any god. Indeed, the medieval popes claimed to be God. Verse 38, but in their place, he shall honor a god of fortresses. Political, civil, and military power was used to maintain spiritual control in the name of God. By the way, we haven't read verses 38 and 39. Let's read them. In their place he shall honor a god of fortresses and a god which his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Let's look at that now. The god of fortresses. The church, medieval, turned to civil fortress, civil power, in order to maintain spiritual control. Instead of honoring the God of heaven, he honors the god of physical fortress and power. And a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, precious stones and precious things. The church accumulation of great wealth with top
leaders living like kings seems to be suggested here. Ornate statues and relics were collected and revered and worshipped. Verse 39, thus he shall act against the strongest fortress with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance his glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. He shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god. The medieval Christianity advanced pagan beliefs in the name of Christ and by the power of the state. And he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. It's called simony, or the sale of church offices to the highest bidder. This practice is actually what goaded Martin Luther into writing the 95 Theses, which served to launch the Reformation. You recall the story, a guy by the name of, before we get to him, there was a one of the nobility up in German area who wanted to be the next archbishop. Now, the only way you could become the next archbishop was if you could pay the papal power the highest amount over anybody else and thus buy the office. Didn't have anything to do with being spiritual. It had purely to do with power and money. And indeed, we find that the emissaries of the whoever it was, I don't remember his name right now. For some reason, I'm thinking Albert of Hohenzollern, but I probably am wrong on that. One of these guys up north wanted to be the next archbishop, so he sent his emissaries down, and they bickered back and forth with the Pope. And it is actually true, it's recorded history, that the Pope said he wanted 12,000 ducats, 1,000 for each of the 12 apostles. And they came back with the counteroffer of 7,000 ducats. I think it was one for each of the seven deadly sins or something like that. And the answer that came back to that was, okay, we'll settle for 10. And I believe that was one for each of the Ten Commandments. I mean, this is religious and righteous stuff going on here. We're quoting the Bible, but we're doing pure business. And indeed, now, the prince from up north had to figure out how to raise the 10,000 ducats, because he didn't have that much money. So the Pope decided to help him out. And they began to sell indulgences. You know what indulgences are? Yeah. It means if you buy this and you have this piece of paper, you can go out and sin because it's already been forgiven. And the indulgence you could buy an indulgence for your grandmother who was in purgatory or hell, see? And of course, once people died back then, now we put them all in heaven, see? Back then, the church put them all in purgatory so that you could pay to have prayers prayed so that you could get them out. So now all your poor relatives are down there in purgatory or hell, whichever how bad they were. And if you would buy this piece of paper, Tetzel was the name of a little man that the only reason we know him because he got mixed up with Martin Luther. Tetzel comes through Martin Luther's area selling indulgences, which the money goes to raise money for this prince up north so he can pay it to the Pope and become the archbishop. That's what it's all about. And Tetzel preached that when the money clinks into the chest, the soul of your departed loved one will relieve the agonies of purgatory and enter into the bliss of heaven. A little short, fat guy. He preached up a storm. And of course, the people bought these things left and right because they were under total superstition at this time. The church held their souls in its hands. And Luther ran into some of his parishioners not acting like Christians. And they said, "Oh, no problem, Father. Look what I have." And they come out with his indulgence. "I've already been forgiven for this." And Luther got so angry that he went home and he wrote out 95 statements against indulgences and the whole practice of simony, selling, dividing the land for gain by the church. And he nailed it to the door of the church in Wittenberg. And thus began the Reformation. I mean, there were other reformers before, but that's what Luther was the first successful reformer in breaking the control of the papal power over an entire area of the country. Dividing the land for gain. And that's where we'll close for tonight. Like I told you, this was going to be a historical marathon, but we did it in less than an hour. Now, let's step back for just a minute and try and get our bearings. The whole thing is God explaining to Daniel how his people are going to be caught over the next centuries between these two warring powers. First of all, it was Ptolemy versus Seleucid, and they're warring at each other. When Rome steps in and takes over the north, moves down, takes over the south, and then they're under the control of Rome, we have the period of the three Caesars, the one who suddenly falls, the raiser of taxes, and the one who goes against the prince of princes. Then we move on to where the language absolutely parallels the medieval little horn power of Daniel 7 and Daniel 8 and adds some more details and brings us down to chapter 11, verse 40, which says, at the time of the end. Now, it said that this power would go on until the time of the end. Now, chapter 11, verse 40 says something happens at the time of the end. When is that time? And what's going on? And that's where we'll pick up next week. And we'll see that indeed it takes us over the last couple hundred years right up into the present and right down into the future. And indeed it takes up the period of time that Revelation will expand on. Okay? So that's where we are. Any questions? When Paul talks about being aware of ravenous wolves, I believe that's in about Acts chapter, it's the early 20s, where he's talking to the Ephesian elders, and he says, even from among yourselves will arise people to draw away followers after themselves. I looked at that when we were studying Daniel 7, and I suggested that indeed that is exactly what Paul was talking about. He recognized that there would be a falling away, 2 Thessalonians 2, that would come between his time and the time of the coming of Christ, in which the man of sin would be revealed and be finally destroyed by Christ himself. Yes? Already starting in Paul's day, John says Antichrist is already at work, and it continues on. Yes? Anyone else? Okay, we won't do another one quite like this, all right? So if you said I've had enough history for a week, that's fine. I don't blame you. Next Saturday night, we're going to do what I think to be, for me, one of the most fascinating attempts to decipher what has been a real hot topic in Adventism. Who's the king of the north? Who's the king of the south? We've been arguing this for 100 years. We had a major church split over it in 1888 and other times. But I have it all figured out, so just come on out and... Now, I had someone who shared some things with me that it finally made sense, number one, and number two, it dovetailed perfectly with Revelation. So that gave a little confirmation. So I'll share something with you that you may not have heard next week. All right? Let's stand together for a prayer. Lord, thank you tonight that we can see by stepping back from this passage that you have known everything all along. And therefore, if we're the ones caught in the middle between the warring forces of this world, we can know that you are not caught off guard. You know what's happening. Sometimes you protect us, sometimes you don't. But you are the resurrection and the life. And if we're struck down here, we'll be raised up for eternity. Lord, help us to have the kind of faith in you to trust our lives to you that completely, we pray. Give us a safe journey home tonight, a wonderful week, a productive one, one in which we can share you through our lives with many people. Bring us together again to worship and study next weekend, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.